to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Every time you buy a hunting or fishing license in Alberta, a significant portion of that money goes towards the Alberta Conservation Association. And the ACA, in turn, uses the money to fund research on conservation issues. The ACA grants in biodiversity support students who are studying plants and wildlife as part of their master's and PhD programs. Their findings on elk, wolves, birds, and grasslands, just to name a few topics, are changing the way we manage for conservation values in this province. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One of the most important steps towards conserving our wildlife resources is finding out what's out there and what the habitats are like. Over the last few years, much of that basic research has been conducted by university students working on their master's and PhD theses, thanks to support by the Alberta Conservation Association. This funding program is called the ACA Grants in Biodiversity, and the new program leader is Dr. Lee Foote, an associate professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta.
This program is an innovative program to provide money for graduate students and postdoctoral fellows that are working on flora and fauna in Alberta. It's funded by the Alberta Conservation Association and their associated partners, and it puts about $200,000 per year into Alberta research for species that you might not ordinarily think of, everything from fungi to bighorn sheep.
Who can apply for these grants?
Any sanctioned research institution anywhere in the world can apply for these grants. However, the caveat is the research has to be conducted in Alberta. It has to benefit our resources.
You're just taking over from Dr. Bill Samuel and heading up the program. What is it that you would like to accomplish with this?
Well, I'd like to continue on in Bill's footsteps. He has some big shoes to fill. Bill ushered us through the first decade of this program, awarding some $2 million worth of grants. We're up to almost $2,400,000 in grants that have been awarded to postdoctoral fellows and graduate students. I'd like to continue this program, but I'd also like to grow it. And I'd also like the people of Alberta to have a little wider recognition and appreciate that. So thanks for the little info here, Cheryl.
Well, when you say you want to grow it, what do you mean?
Well, there's some thought that $200,000 is a lot of money. But when we slice that up into $10,000 blocks to support entire research programs, we'd like to sponsor a lot more graduate students. We currently have more qualified applicants applying each year, usually something around 50 people applying. And we're only able to award to about half of those. And there are needs out there. There are lots of excellent projects that don't get funded. We do have an approximately 50% success rate, which is higher than many of the granting agencies.
What's happening with all the information that these students and researchers are pulling together?
Lots of things. First of all, they often address specific pressing problems. It might be bighorn sheep genetics. It might be elk wintering range. It might be something like endangered coneflowers in Alberta. These are things that ordinarily would not have been researched. We wouldn't know what the extent of the problems were. Some of it's an insurance policy for the biota of our province, but there's some hidden benefits that come out of this. What we have is an emerging cadre of top-notch young scientists that are peopling the Sustainable Resource Development Agency, that are going to work for Alberta Conservation Association, that are going to work for industry and reclamation projects. It's raising the whole bar. I like the analogy that a rising tide floats all boats, and we're trying to raise the level of scholarship and keep the emphasis on a lot of natural resource research. There, we have a great engineering faculty, a great arts faculty, but funding's quite hard to come by for a lot of these top-name biological researchers. And we're really proud to be able to support some of these students.
The money for these grants comes through the Alberta Conservation Association, and that ultimately comes from hunters and anglers in Alberta. How does the work or the information that these students are coming up with, how does that fit into the management of our resources?
Excellent question. Hunters and anglers' license fees are what support about 75% of the Alberta Conservation Association's budget. From that, we get awarded this $200,000 per year. Now, it's a rather narrow-minded focus to think that only game species should be supported by this research, because hunters and anglers are some of our foremost conservationists in the province. They're our front guard. They're our insurance policy when things go awry, when habitat destruction is occurring. And that's not just habitat for hunted and hooked species. I personally am a hunter. There have been plenty of times I've sat in a what seemed like a biological desert, a sterile planted rows of pine with lots of say, white-tailed deer in there. It's not the same aesthetic experience as being immersed in a rich natural habitat with red-breasted nuthatches buzzing at me and great gray owls flitting through, things that I'm not hunting, but I'm absorbing. And that's what the passionate environmentalist hunter angler is looking for, is an experience, not just meat on the table, not just an opportunity for a trophy, not just these simple things, but a broad, rich, real experience in a complete, intact ecosystem. In order for us to know that that's happening, that that's available, we have to study the lousewort. We have to study the passerine birds. These are the species that make Alberta a rich, great environment, not just our treasured game species.
What are some things that stand out for you that have come out of the research that's been done by through this grant program? Are there a couple of things that really Sure. have changed the way we look at nature?
Yeah, there really are. One of our students, Ivor Norling, for example, was studying something that's seemingly as esoteric as phytoplankton or zooplankton in boreal ponds. As we dig a little deeper in this, we start seeing the linkages. These small microorganisms that are also influencing the algae in these ponds that also influences waterfowl habitat. This ties right into Ducks Unlimited's mandate, right into conservation issues. As we alter our boreal forest, we need to be on guard for how we change the most basic, simple, tiny denizens of these ponds, because it could ultimately influence how many waterfowl we produce. Interesting study by Fanny Pelletier, looking at reproductive costs in bighorn sheep, something as simple as studying the droppings of these guys to see what the testosterone level and the corticosteroid levels of these sheep were. Bighorn sheep are an interesting case where maybe the biggest are not the fittest. Maybe the biggest overstress themselves during the winter and pass away prematurely. We don't know this. And if we're going to exploit these populations, we need to understand how animals move through the age ranks, whether it's in a park population or in a hunted population.
Thank you very much, Lee.
It's always a delight. Thank you.
That was Dr. Lee Foote, Associate Professor in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta and Program Leader for the Alberta Conservation Association's Grants in Biodiversity Fund. One young doctoral candidate who is studying the relationship between elk and wolves is Mark Hebblewhite. His study area includes the Yahatinda Ranch on Alberta's eastern slopes. Yahatinda is the Stony Sioux word for mountain prairie. Biologists have noticed that in the last few years, most of the elk that overwinter on the Yahatinda have stopped migrating in the spring to feed in Banff National Park. While Mark's research covers a lot of different factors, one of his projects looks at what influence fires and salvage logging might have on elk migration. And that's supported by the Alberta Conservation Association through its Grants in Biodiversity program.
Well, Yahatinda actually means mountain prairie, and so it's a really important high-elevation rough fescue grassland. And so elk from about a 5,000 or 6,000 square kilometer area, all of Banff National Park, all migrate back to Yahatinda in the winter. And it's probably Alberta's largest elk herd. Somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 elk make Yahatinda home and the region surrounding it. And so Yahatinda is a really critical place for elk in Alberta. And because it's a really critical place for elk, wolves really like elk. And so where you find elk, you find wolves. And the Yahatinda ranch area is used by two or three different wolf packs. And wolf packs, a lot of the wolf packs in Banff National Park also, you know, use the elk that live in the Yahatinda. So it's a really key place in Alberta for sort of wolf and elk populations.
The thing that I find intriguing is that you have a very large project that has a number of little projects in amongst it. Can you give us the big picture first?
Sure, yeah. No, this is a really fun project. And the big picture is about 5 years ago, both park managers and provincial biologists noticed that there were less and less elk that were leaving the ranch in the summertime. Basically, there was less elk migrating back into Banff National Park. So you can imagine a Banff park manager looking at the number of elk returning into the park and worrying if there's less and less elk, why is that happening? At the same time, in Alberta, provincial wildlife biologists would be looking at Yaha Tinda. And Yaha Tinda, as I said before, it's this rough fescue grassland. And elk, it's very important that the rough fescue gets a break from grazing in the summertime. It's very important that these elk leave in the summer. That's when rough fescue grows again. It's one of the rarest and best preserved rough fescue grasslands in the province. And so if these elk just camp out on it all summer long, it's like any farmer or rancher knows, you have to rotate your livestock. And so basically by migrating, elk have sort of naturally evolved a natural rotational grazing system. And so with more and more elk staying at the ranch, there's enough concern by the park and the province to sort of prompt the initiation of the study in 2001 to really basically get at the question, why are these elk not migrating anymore? And how does habitat play a role in influencing elk migration?
What are some of the things that you're finding out that would give you some answers into that?
So in the large study, one thing that we found for sure, we definitely have documented that there have been really important declines in migratory behavior. In the late 70s, 5% of the population would stay at Yaha Tinda in the winter, or in the summer, I mean. Basically, the entire population migrated every summer. Now we're seeing somewhere between 40 and 50% of all the elk never leave the ranch. They're there all summer long, and this is definitely a new and important phenomenon. Some of the things we've discovered is that these elk migrate all the way to Yoho, Lake Louise, the Icefields Parkway. So elk that people see on Highway 93 by the Icefields Parkway have migrated 60, 70 kilometers from Yaha Tinda. And so this is really important to sort of demonstrate how important the park is to the province, but also how important the province is to the park. Now, in terms of some of the reasons why elk migration is changing, there's a number of potential things that we're investigating. Obviously, wolves recolonized the park right around the mid-80s, and so that's a big difference. Maybe wolf predation in the park is influencing things. There's also a series of large fires, and that's really the sort of focus of the project that the ACA Challenge Grant is focused on, is how do fires influence elk migration? Most notably, I guess, in 2001, there was a large fire outside the park just south of Yaha Tinda. And one of the, concerns or issues that could potentially be raised is that maybe now these elk won't migrate into the park if they have these great fires to stay around outside of Banff National Park.
What is it that attracts them about fires?
Well, fires are actually, that's a great question. So what fires does do for elk and other wildlife species, like other ungulates, bighorn sheep, fires are really crucial in that it rejuvenates and restores, forests, older forests to younger stands, younger age of forests. And it also rejuvenates areas like grasslands. And so by rejuvenate, what I mean is it basically converts all that old, grass and stuff that, old grass species that animals like elk don't want to eat. It burns them off and then replenishes the soil with nutrients and really opens things up and allows a new flush of growth that's not only more abundant than it was before the burn, but it tastes better, basically. It's higher digestibility for the elk, and elk can make basically an easier time eating, fresh forage that comes off a new fire. And so, fire is very important for species of deer, et cetera, like elk, because it really does sort of restart the system for them.
One of the things that's happening in Alberta, because we have had a number of large fires throughout the last few years, is we're also salvaging the burned logs. Is that having any impact or influence?
No, great question, Cheryl. And so specifically one of the focuses of the ACA Challenge Grants in terms of my research is to just specifically address how does salvage logging affect elk. So salvage logging is kind of a funny word. Basically, it means the forestry companies want to go in after a burn and salvage something out of that burn for them. And so by salvage logging, what they do is they go in and cut the burned timber. And then that, you can imagine, turns something that was a burned forest into now a burned, basically, cut block. And so It's unclear at the beginning of this research. We did a really good review in trying to find out what was known about how salvage logging might influence ungulates, and not a whole lot was known, and even less was known here in Alberta. So our study is really one of the first to specifically look at sort of the effects of salvage logging in foothills and the mountain regions of Alberta on species like elk.
What are you finding?
So we're just completing our research on this in this aspect right now. And so what we've done is with this dog rib burn that burned through about 4,000 to 5,000 hectares of primarily lodgepole just south of Yaha Tinda, we've tracked it for the first 3 years post-burn. And so for the first 3 years post-burn, what we're finding is that these salvage logged areas have less utility, basically, for species like elk. There's less biomass of grass species is less in the burns. There's less forbs for them to eat. And we, even though that sort of is recovering, 2, 3, 4 years after the burn, we will think it'll recover even more next year. There's still a big difference between there's a lot less forage for species like elk in salvage logging in the first 3 years post salvage logging in the burn.
What does that mean then?
Well, I think it means right now there's not really many guidelines for salvage logging after fires go in. So there'll be a big fire, and we're going to see more and more big fires like this, in especially the foothills of Alberta, both for management and also climate change reasons. And after a fire goes, the pressure's really on to get some of that timber out. And right now, there's not, as I said, there isn't much known about how salvage logging might affect elk. And so one of the things that we're going to be able to do is provide some really concrete guidelines to say, listen, if your objectives are to enhance elk habitat, then we recommend that you don't log these sort of areas after burns, because they have more value for species like elk left uncut than they do cut. Alternately, we're also looking at how the different kinds of salvage logging affect conifer regeneration. So forestry companies are very interested in that, in so much that it might create a win-win situation where they can look at an area and say, listen, if we cut this burn, we're really going to have to spend lots of money reseeding it. Why don't we just leave it for elk habitat, and then we'll go on, we can do some salvage logging over in this other area. And so really, by trying to find out, I guess, the best ways to and promote best practices with salvage logging, those are the kinds of practical tools we'll be able to provide the forest industry.
If elk are then attracted to these areas that have recently burned, and they're not migrating where they would have, what is that doing then for their predator, the wolf? Is that drawing wolves into those areas?
That's a great question. And to be honest, that's one of the main thrusts of the overall research, because there's been lots of research. In Yellowstone, for example, there was a large, well-publicized 1988 burns that saw half the park burned down. And so in Yellowstone, there was a 20 to 30% increase in elk populations after that burn. And we know from elsewhere in other studies that when you burn large amounts of habitat, you really do see an increase in ungulate populations, right? As I said before, there's basically more food, and more food will equal more elk. One of the key differences, I think, in our study area and in most of Alberta when compared to Yellowstone is we actually have a big, healthy, vibrant predator community in some of these areas, including not just wolves but grizzly bears and, of course, humans. And so one of the main thrusts of my research is to ask basically, can you use fire to increase elk populations in the presence of predation by carnivores like wolves versus areas like Yellowstone? And preliminarily, I think there are ways that we can do that. What I see is the areas where elk populations are doing the best. It's not just the fact that there's a forest fire there, but it's the arrangement of that forest fire. Basically, you can imagine two scenarios where you burn an entire valley bottom, or you burn high elevation sort of little habitat patches up where it's hard for wolves to get to, but where the elk can then find food and avoid wolf predation. And so by sort of, looking at the different ways in landscape arrangements that you can make out there by burning, we can provide managers guidelines. If you're going to, use fire to enhance wildlife habitat and your objectives are to increase elk and other wildlife, don't do burns like this. Do burns, like this. Maybe, smaller, more dispersed burns are better than bigger, large ones that might just attract wolves in, as you say.
Are you at the point where you could say there's a take-home message?
Well, I think our projects will be wrapped up completely within the next year. In terms of take-home messages, we are showing that salvage logging does influence elk habitat within the first 3 years post-burn. Of course, it's going to be important to continue to track that after, the effects of salvage logging after 3 years. Within the overall study, there's been some real clear indications that fire does benefit elk. habitat quality and the amount of forage that's there. I think the next step for me then is to really take it in this next year as I complete the analysis of the project to the so what stage and answer, is fire successful at actually increasing elk populations and under what circumstances? And so I think yes, within a year, we'll be able to provide answers to those questions.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. It's been a pleasure.
That was Mark Hebblewhite, a doctoral candidate at the University of Alberta. His project on salvage logging and elk migration is supported by the Alberta Conservation Association's Grants and Biodiversity Program. North of the Yahatinda is the Little Smoky River. That's where you'll find caribou, wolves, and Layla Neufeld. Layla is a master's student working with Dr. Fiona Schmigelow at the University of Alberta. Caribou are a threatened species in Alberta, and industrial activity is making that situation worse. The research that Layla is doing will eventually lead to better management guidelines for caribou, and some of that research is funded by the Alberta Conservation Association's Grants and Biodiversity Program.
Well, we're working with the Little Smoky Caribou Range, and we're looking at two major things. One is how caribou and wolves use their habitat, basically where they are, when they are, and how they are there. And also we're looking at mitigation techniques of blocking seismic lines and looking at how wolves use seismic lines.
Where is the Little Smoky?
The Little Smoky is basically halfway between Fox Creek and Grand Cache, north of Hinton, on the Little Smoky River.
Now, you talked about how wolves are using seismic lines and mitigation there. What are you doing there?
Well, the Caribou Range Restoration Project has actually collaborated with us, and we had a great opportunity to look at how seismic lines can be blocked, essentially, by falling trees over top of a line, and whether this has any effect on animal movement through the caribou range.
Well, why is that a concern?
Well, it's a concern because past research has shown that wolves are highly efficient at moving on seismic lines, and we're concerned about that because the Little Smoky caribou herd is declining very rapidly, and we think there may be some connection there between wolves and caribou and some industrial features, and we want to look at how to make it better.
So you've fallen some trees on there. Why?
Trees are one example of how we can reduce predator movement or inhibit predator movement, or at least maybe slow predator movement down a little bit. Trees act as sort of a blockade. They kind of impede movement, and we're basically looking at whether this is a good method for slowing wolves down or any predators on seismic lines.
How are you watching that?
Well, we have a couple of ways to monitor it. We're monitoring it first with remote cameras. So we have 34 remote cameras set up. We've taken them down now. And they have an infrared sensor that is triggered when an animal walks by, and it takes a still photo of the animal that has walked by. And so we've placed cameras on either side of the blockage to look at who is using these lines.
Do you have any problems keeping those cameras up and running?
Oh, we have a lot of problems with cameras. Bears tend to really enjoy playing with cameras. We have a lot of pictures of moose heads and bear behinds and all sorts of things. So, yeah, there's definitely problems with them. But
what do? Climb up the trees and get them down?
Yeah, I think they really like the flash. They actually tend to come up to the camera and play around with it and grab it and pull it off and the transmitters and all sorts of things. I mean, you see everything. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Who's going up and down these lines then?
Well, we have all sorts of species. We've recorded black bears, grizzly bears, lynx, white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, caribou, of course, and wolves, of course. So we've got a lot of species using seismic lines.
What does that mean?
It means that seismic lines are an important feature. And essentially in the Little Smoky, it's difficult to get away from seismic lines. There's 85% of the range is within 250 meters of a seismic line. So they're a ubiquitous feature, and they're actually used by a number of species.
So you've got all these pictures. You know who's using the lines. What do you take from that?
Well, from the pictures, we look at the rate of use because we have to compare things equally. So we've set up cameras in control areas where we don't have seismic lines blocked and in treatment areas where seismic lines are blocked. We get from that a rate of use, and we determine whether seismic lines with a block on them are actually deterring movement.
What is the rate?
The rate is very low because the cameras are up for a long time. The lines aren't used very highly, so we have an animal every, it's highly dependent on the line, but say a busy line would have an animal every 3 times, 4 times a day.
So over the summer, you gathered all this information. Now what are you going to do with it? What does it tell you? What sort of conclusions do you draw from that?
Well, it's important because people are starting to look at ways of getting rid of some of these industrial features. So this will be the first study to sort of look at what's effective and what isn't effective. We can build on this, and we can hopefully start to mitigate some of these industrial disturbances in the Little Smoky Caribou Range.
How would you mitigate?
Well, if this is effective, we can mitigate with this tree blocking program, and we can block seismic lines and deter animals from using lines. There's also other techniques that the Caribou Range Restoration Project has basically put out, things like line mounding, tree planting, and different ways of just recovering seismic lines.
You've done this one project, but how does that fit into the bigger research picture of what you're doing overall with caribou and wolves?
We're working on a couple of different things in the Little Smoky. The first one is basically looking at where animals are and when they are and modeling what they select for in the Little Smoky Caribou Range, both wolves and caribou. And secondly, we're doing this mitigation project. We've basically put out a number of GPS collars. So these collars collect information and then tell us where the animal has been in the last year or 5 months or however long the collar was on. We've put 17 on caribou and 16 on wolves in 5 packs in the range. And we're looking at how animals use their environment and what they select in that environment.
From the information that you've collected so far, what are some of the things that you found out about how these animals are using the range?
Well, it looks like animals seem to be pretty much everywhere, but we have to break it down a little bit more into detail temporally into different times of the year. So it's important to know where wolves are when wolves are denning, because it's the same time that caribou are calving. And this seems to be the biggest period in time where caribou are dying, is during this calving time, and it's very critical. So when we break it down into these smaller time periods, we'll start to see finer detail and hopefully come up with some good conclusions that can be used in the future for some management programs.
What got you interested in studying wolves and caribou?
Oh, well, who doesn't want to work on wolves and caribou? I grew up, I guess, in a very rural sort of setting, and this seemed like the most outdoors sort of wildlife works I could do. And I'm just generally very interested in wildlife and wildlife management and working on animals that are close to home for me.
And how important are caribou and wolves to what's happening out there in Alberta? Because you have said that this particular herd is really on the decline.
Well, that's a bit of a question that has some opinion in it, and you'll hear different answers to this question depending who you ask. Wolves and caribou, I guess, to me, are sort of iconic species of the boreal forest, and caribou, a threatened species in Canada, basically sort of show that something's going on out there. There are some things changing because all of our herds are either declining or some stable, but most in decline, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Layla Neufeld, a master's student in the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. She's a recipient of funding from the Alberta Conservation Association's Grants in Biodiversity Program. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, Science Alberta Foundation, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and Ducks Unlimited Canada. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.